Don't you just hate silence? Isn't silence just awful? Not silence when you're alone. Silence when you're alone is restful. But silence when there's two of you. Silence when someone is supposed to be talking. Silence means something in those situations, doesn't it? It means bad news is coming. Or it may mean bad news has already come and there's nothing I can say to make you feel better, so I'm just going to sit here. But it's almost never a happy sign. Silence is almost never a happy sound. Don't you just hate silence? And the worst kind of silence of them all is the kind of silence that comes when we cry out to God for an answer. If He would just explain Himself, if He would just tell us why He is doing what He has chosen to do, we could get it. We'd be okay. But He won't. He makes us wait. He leaves us with the silence. Last week we studied Jesus as the Lord of the wine, the master of the house, the keeper of the feast, the one who fills every glass, the one who answers prayer requests before they're even uttered, the one who brings deep, unending joy to every darkness. The Lord of the wine. And this week, we're going to study the Lord of the whips. The Lord of disruption. The Lord of terrible silence. The Lord that we would rather not talk about at all. And what I want you to understand is John is extremely careful to put these two stories together. He does it on purpose. Ask an English teacher if you don't believe me. I'll show you in just a moment. He puts these two together on purpose. And I believe that what he's trying to tell us is if our Christianity is going to stand up to the test of truth, if your Christianity is going to be an adult faith, a faith that you can keep for the rest of your life, you're going to have to get used to the fact that you do not always get the Lord of the wine. Every Christian has to learn to live with and ultimately learn to love the Lord of the whips. Because it's all the same Lord. He's all the same. And what I want you to see this morning is that Jesus is the Lord of the whips for the exact same reason that He's the Lord of the wine. He loves us. And as the Lord of the whips, He is training us to love only Him. He is training us to trust only Him. Please stand as we read this confusing text from John chapter 2, beginning with verse 13. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, He found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, He drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen. And He poured out the coins of the money changers, and He overturned their tables. And He told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. Do not make My Father's house a house of trade." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So the Jews said to Him, "What sign do you show for us for doing these things?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple. Will you raise it up in 3 days?" But He was speaking about the temple of His body. When therefore He was raised from the dead, His disciples remembered that He had said this, and they believed the Scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. Thus far, the reading of God's word. Please be seated. Jesus is the Lord of the whips for the exact same reason that he's the Lord of the wine. He is the Lord of the whips because he loves us. And he is training us to love only him, and he is training us to trust only him. Now, the first thing I want you to see is this is a necessary tension. These two stories that show a completely opposite side of the same person are wed together on purpose. They're wed together on purpose. Now, some people who are careful readers of the Bible and other people who are looking for inconsistencies in the Bible will point out that Matthew, Mark, and Luke all have the story of Jesus cleansing the temple, but they all put it when? At the end of his life. Days before he went to the cross. And John sticks it here at the beginning of his gospel. Now, the important thing for you to see is, and there's all kinds of possible answers. Some people will say, well, Jesus actually did it twice. They're trying to look for the easy way out. Others people will say, well, maybe Matthew, Mark, and Luke put it at the beginning of his life, at the end of his life, because they're trying to group all the things that he did in Jerusalem under one heading, which is actually true. They are all doing that. They only have him going to Jerusalem once. John has him in Jerusalem several times. But I think the much more reasonable answer is this. John is writing thematically for people who already know the stories. He wrote this gospel decades after the other gospels were written. And everything he's doing and the way that he is doing it is there to tell us something. And he ties these two stories together beautifully. Now, first of all, if you'll notice, up until now, every text we've read has had a time signature to it, right? The next day, the day after, the third day. Those kind of things all come at the beginning of these stories. All this time signature says is it was around the time of the Passover. And now we could have assumed, we can, I guess, assume that the Passover was right after the wedding in Cana. But we're not told that. We're just told it was around the time of the Passover. It could have been 3 years later. That's not the point. But he does tie these two stories together fascinatingly in this. What was the first thing he said about the wedding at Cana? Remember, it was an interesting little phrase, and we said that doesn't really make, you wouldn't expect to see it there. He says, on the third day. It's on the third day. Oh, okay. And then, when did the disciples figure out what he had done? After the resurrection. And how does he explain why he destroyed the temple? He said, destroy this temple, and I'll build it back on the third day. And he puts these two stories together. He binds them together so that you're seeing two sides of the same person. And it's necessary for us to hold these together. John is telling us that there's only one God. He is both. He is both the keeper of the feast and he is the keeper of the darkness. He is the Lord of the wine and he is the Lord of the whips. And it is extremely difficult to keep both of those in mind. Most of us come from a tradition that chooses one or the other. A lot of us who found a home here come from a tradition who honestly, frankly, thought it was easier to talk about the Lord of the whips, the Lord of self-discipline, the Lord of self-denial, the Lord who never answers prayer, so don't get your hopes up. I was that guy. I remember people telling me, I pray for parking spots, and I would say, you idiot. God's got much bigger things in mind than your parking spot. And so I had this amazing ability as a young minister to make people feel bad about feeling bad, right? Because they would come in feeling bad because they had prayed for something and not gotten it, and I would jump on them and say, well, you should feel bad about praying for that. Wasn't that pastoral of me? I was good. I was a good guy. But it's easier. You see, it's easier to not get your hopes up, isn't it? It's easier to always expect God to say no. There's no disappointment there. Because if we just say, God's not like that. It's easier to have just the Lord of the whips than it is to have the Lord of the wine and the whips. Other traditions focus only on the Lord of the wine. More Pentecostal-type traditions will focus on the Lord who always answers prayer. The Lord who always wants you to be happy and healthy and wealthy. The Lord who is always there at your fingertips. And when he's not, they also find ways to blame it on you. You didn't ask in faith. You didn't ask right. Isn't it funny? We always find a way to blame it on you, don't we? That's what pastors are paid for. Just kidding. It's not our job to blame it on you. The true God of the Bible is both, and the fact that he is both is what is so maddening. What is so maddening about the true God of the Bible is that he is both to the same people at different times, sometimes to the same family. He is both the God who, when you are calling out to him that you are lonely, he makes the phone ring seconds later. And he is the God who, when you pray that your daughter would have a close friend, just one friend in the entire school, 10 years later, she's still at home on weekends waiting for that phone to ring. The same God. The same family. He is the God who makes some of our children scholarship athletes or national merit scholars. And he is the God who makes some of our children or let some of our children be mentally ill. He is the God who gives us pregnancies when we come down here and we anoint people with oil and they beg the Lord to heal their infertility and give them children and they get pregnant days, weeks later. And he is the God who gives miscarriages. He's the God who gives some of us wonderful jobs and blesses your faithful work with career advancement and with financial and status blessings. And he is the God who lets some holy, godly, responsible, wonderful people be unemployed and underemployed for years. Isn't that frustrating? It'd be so much easier if it were just one or the other, if he would just make up his mind. But if he's truly God, then he has the capacity to be both. And actually, I think if we really expect him to be more than just a one-dimensional character, he's got to be both. You see, if he's truly God, what do we want from God? We want someone who's big enough to answer our deepest problems. We want someone who is big enough to heal the world of all its deepest, darkest sins. And if you want a God who's that big, then you have to believe that he also has wisdom enough to know when to say no to you. He has more, if he's greater than you, if he's bigger than you, then by definition he's also wiser than you. And he's going to know that the right answer sometimes is silence. Sometimes it's no. It's like this. I'm a dad, right? And when my kids were little, I basically saw my job as being two things. I was the dad of ice cream. I was the rewarder. I was the one who took a good event and made it awesome, right? So mom plans a birthday party with cake and balloons and a few friends, and I bring in pirates and water balloons and surprise onslaughts, and we just happen to have water balloons to fight back. I'm the good guy. I'm the one who makes it fun. And I'm the one who puts you in the car a couple times a year and takes you to get shots. And I take these same children that I love for the exact same reason that I give them the parties. I bind their hands and I bind their feet and I hold their head. If you've had a squirmy kid, you know this feeling. And I hold them down while a complete stranger comes at them with a sharp instrument, impales them, and injects them with potentially deadly viruses. That's called an inoculation. And I do both because I love my kids. I do them both for the same reason. Because I want them to grow strong and healthy. And I want them to enjoy life. And I want them to enjoy it for a long time. That's what an independent, wise father does. And if you want God, then you have to accept his independence and his wisdom. And if you don't want that, then basically just admit you don't want God. You want a genie in a bottle. It's not, there's nothing wrong with wanting a genie in a bottle. I would love a genie in a bottle. If you find one, would you please give it to me when you're done? Right? Because a genie has great power but no freedom. He's your slave. Who doesn't want that? It's just not God. He's not interested in being your slave. He loves you, but he is not looking to be your slave. He gives good gifts to his children, even when you can't imagine how it's good. That's what it means to worship a true God who is good and who loves you. He doesn't want you to love the stuff that he gives you. He wants you to love him. And therefore, sometimes he is the Lord of the whips. When he sees us loving the stuff that he's given us more than we love him, he comes in with his whip and he disrupts our life and he cleanses our life because he wants us to love only him and trust only him. The first thing I want you to see is this tension. You've got to have, if you want the true God, you've got to have both. And you see this demonstrated here, secondly, in this disruptive demonstration. And that's what it was. It was a disruption and a demonstration. Look at verses 14 through 17. Now, some of us have got this picture in our mind of this kind of violent Jesus, right? Especially those of us who have heard a lot about kind of the real manhood type stuff. I used to teach real men retreats, you know, and call on these boys to be real men, and men are violent, and this is the example of the violent Jesus, and that was all stupid. Pay attention to what's happening here. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers sitting here, there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with sheep and with and the oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers, and he overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade." And his disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So what does he do? He walks in to the temple. It's Passover. All Jews are supposed to come. All God fears. Everyone who worships Yahweh is supposed to come to the temple and make their sacrifice. And so he walks into this area that was known as the courtyard of the Gentiles. It is where those who had not yet been circumcised, who had not yet become full Jews, would come and worship and learn about the true God. But it had been changed over the years. And what's happened is, as the Jews have been spread out to the different nations, and you actually have more Jews at this point in Alexandria, Egypt, than you do in Jerusalem. You've got them spread out all over the place, and it's hard to travel with a lamb, right? It's just difficult. You don't want to put a sheep in your car. And so, and they didn't have cars. And so what they would do, it's a lot easier to travel with money than it is to travel with a lamb. And so they would just carry their money. Instead of bringing their sacrifices with them, they would bring their money with them. And then they would get to the temple, and we got this courtyard of the Gentiles. That's a convenient place. Let's set up here. And so first you would go to the money changers, right? And the money changers would take your Egyptian money or your Turkish money, and they would turn it into Roman money. And they'd probably take a little bit of a profit, but you don't really mind. They're doing you a favor. And then you go to the table, the ones where they're selling the sacrifices. And if you were poor, you'd buy a pigeon. If you were middle class, you'd buy the middle class sacrifice that I don't remember right now. And if you were wealthy, you'd buy a lamb. I don't know, sheep and oxen. Thank you. You would buy the oxen if you were wealthy, and so they would make a little bit of profit. But hey, raising sheep isn't free, right? We're just kind of recouping the cost of paying the shepherds and everything. And it was easier than bringing. I don't really think they were mad about it. There's not a sense here that there's cheating going on. But Jesus sees that this is all happening in this courtyard that was supposed to be called the house of prayer for all nations. And so he goes and he gathers a bunch of reeds. Now this text says it was made a whip of cords. And the idea there is that it was a lot of something. The Greek is probably closer to reeds. That's what Tim Keller says. You know, I've forgotten all the Greek I ever knew, so I'm not going to lie to you and claim to be an expert. But he says it's reeds. And essentially, the lesson here is this. It's not a bullwhip. Okay? It is not the kind of whip that the Roman soldiers used that ripped the skin off his back. It's more like, I was describing it to Bianca, and she said, "That sounds like a broom." I was like, yeah, it's kind of like a broom. He's knocking over tables with it. He's shooing out the animals with it. He's cleaning the temple. It was a demonstration. It was the kind of thing that prophets would do. He stopped the temple from working. He brought the work of the temple to a halt. And he said, to explain what he was doing, he said, "My father's house should be a house of prayer for all nations, but you've made it a marketplace." What was the purpose of this area? The purpose of this area was to be the one place in the world where everybody, people from all nations, could find truth, where they could find hope, where they could find meaning. where they could find the true God. In the midst of all the false gods out there, here's where the true God, they could find out about him. But instead of making it a place where people from every tribe, nation, and tongue would gather, instead of making it the place where God's promises to Abraham would be answered, that in you all nations of the earth would be blessed, instead of making it that place, they had made it a place of national pride. We're better than you. We're Jews. We've got the true God. We've got the true temple. And they made it a place that was for Jews and for no one else. And they had this courtyard, and outside, and on the back of the courtyard was a huge wall, and they put the signs on those walls saying, "No foreigner is to go beyond the balustrade and the plaza of the temple zone. Whoever is caught doing so will have himself to blame for his death, which will follow." Isn't that a great evangelistic method? I mean, really, don't you think we'd get more conversions here if on the table we put, "Anyone who takes this sacrament unworthily will have himself to blame for his death"? I think that would gather people, really. Maybe we should just put the sign out front, you know, as you drive in. "This place is for Christians who have the true religion. Anyone without the true religion who comes into this building might be killed." I don't know. Maybe it's not the best method of evangelism. We'll think more about that. But what we will think about is this. It is a continual temptation to forget why the church exists. The church exists to reach the world for Christ, to make disciples of all nations. It is not a place where we pride ourselves for being better than the others. It is not a place where we pride ourselves as being better than the outsiders. And when Jesus saw that the temple had become the place where outsiders were kept, where death, where they could only come through the wall at the risk of their own lives, he saw that he was going to have to die to bring the Gentiles in. That's why he says, that's why Paul says in Ephesians 2, "In Christ Jesus, you who are far off have been brought close by the blood of Christ. He is our peace, and he has made both one, the Jews and the Gentiles one, and has broken down the wall of partition between us." What is the temple for? It is to be a house of prayer for all nations. What is the church for? Jack Miller used to say, that the church is the only organization in the world who exists primarily for the good of those who are not members. We exist primarily for the good of people who are not our own members. And the second we lose that focus, when we begin to pride ourselves on how we're better than those on the outside, when the church becomes our badge of honor instead of our mission, we become something that Jesus does not recognize and something that he must come in and clean. It's a continual temptation, isn't it? To label those on the outside as those that we're fighting against instead of those that we're fighting for. And so what does Jesus do? In verses 18 through 22, we see this. "So the Jews said to him," Jesus has cleansed the temple, he's done this demonstration, "and the Jews said to him, 'What sign do you show us for doing these things?'" Now, that's a legitimate question. What they're saying is, what you've just done, that's the kind of thing a prophet would do. That's the kind of thing Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, that's the kind of thing they did. Okay. Well, if you have the authority to do that, prove that you're a prophet. Give us a sign. That's a completely legitimate question. When prophets arose in Israel, they often came with signs. Moses had the signs of turning the sea into blood, the river into blood. Elijah had the sign of bringing down the lightning from heaven. Samuel had the sign of creating the storm in the middle of the day. So they're saying, "Jesus, prove to us that you're this kind of prophet. Prove to us you have the authority to do this." And so he answered them. And he answered them like this. He said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up." And the Jews said, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple. Will you raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking about the temple of his body. And when therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered they had said this, that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. They asked for a sign. Jesus says, okay, I'll give you a sign. Destroy the temple, and I'll build it back in 3 days. And you ready for the infuriating part? He knew they wouldn't understand that. And he didn't explain it. He gave them a sign, knowing there was no way they would know what he was talking about. And he walked off. Not even his closest disciples had any idea what he was talking about until after the resurrection. Nobody understood that he was saying, this temple is closed. My body is the new temple. If you want to see where the true sacrifices between God and man is being made, it's here, not out here in this courtyard. If you want to come and meet God, you have to come meet him here, not in this building anymore. He didn't explain any of that. Isn't that what's so infuriating about him? Honestly. Don't you just sometimes feel like you want to respond to Jesus and say, you want to cry out and say, God, I'll take the shot. I'll take the vaccination. I'll live with the pain. If you'll just tell me why. Am I the only one who's ever thought that in here? Just tell me why. Just explain why I'm having to go through this, and I feel like I'll have the strength to get through it. But Lord, it just really feels like you've fallen asleep at the wheel here. You've disrupted my life. Everything was going fine. Won't you just tell me why? And he won't. And he doesn't. We want to cry out, why do I get miscarriages when millions get unwanted pregnancies? Why can't I have a marriage when all of my friends have seemed so happy? Why can't I keep a job? Why must I watch my wife suffer with chronic pain? Why must I suffer with chronic pain? Why is it me, Lord? Why me? Can't you just tell me? Just if you'll just explain why you're doing this, I'll buck up. I'll be a good citizen. I'll hang in there. I won't complain. I won't cry. If you'll just tell me why. And he won't explain it. Instead, he says, on the third day, you'll get it. On the third day. In 3 days, I'm going to build this back up, and you'll get it then. And after the resurrection on the third day, the disciples got it. And honestly, I know some of you right now are waiting on the third day. You feel like you've been waiting on that third day for decades, for years. When's it going to come? When's God going to explain it? Some of you have come into this building today hoping that the preacher will be smart enough to finally turn that key and let you know why. Why is God not explaining it to you? Why is he breaking the silence? Why won't he break the silence? Why has he disrupted your life? And I'm probably not going to be able to tell you. To my knowledge, I've only been able to tell one person why. Been ordained since 1995, and I've been able to tell one person why his life got disrupted. And the rest of the time, I just have to sit in silence with you. I can't tell you why, usually, but I can tell you something. I can tell you why not. And this I'm absolutely certain of. It is not because God doesn't love you. I can promise you that. It can't possibly be that. It can't possibly be that you are sitting in silence because God has forgotten you, and I know that. I know that because this Jesus who went into that temple this day, and he was so angry that his disciples said, zeal for his Father's house has consumed him. I know that actually that prophecy wouldn't be fulfilled for a few more days until he's put up on the cross, and he's so anxious. He is so zealous to have you with him, to have his entire church body with him. He is so zealous for that he is truly consumed by the Father in heaven's wrath. He did that for you. He did that because he wants you with him so badly. So it can't be because he doesn't love you. It can't be because he doesn't love you, because when he cleaned out the temple, he did it with a whip of cords or a whip of reeds. But when he went to claim his temple, when he became the temple, it was with the true whip and the Roman soldiers ripping the flesh off of his back. And he did it voluntarily for you because he loves you that much. So it can't be because he doesn't love you. It can't be because he doesn't love you, because the temple that was his body would be truly torn down, absolutely devastated in every way, voluntarily, to be with you. He can't be because he doesn't love you, because for you, he would cry out from the cross, God, why have you forsaken me? And he would face the silence for you. It's not because he doesn't love you, because on the third day he would be raised up. And that temple would be glorious for us. And he would go before us to prepare a place. And he is waiting on you there. Because of all that I know, I want you to know that you can trust him. I can't tell you why specifically you're waiting on an answer, but I can tell you this, you can trust him. He's good. He's good. I know that he loves you. And I know that when you look into his loving face, you'll understand why. When you look into his face, you will know that you can trust him. And when he wipes the last tear out of your eyes, you will realize that the way he did it was the perfectly right way to do it. And you will understand. I know this. I absolutely know this. God loves you so much that he gave you his only son. And he didn't do that to watch you suffer. He did not do that so he could forget about you. I promise you that. Isaiah 49 tells us, can a woman forget her nursing child, that she should have no compassion on the son of her womb? Yes. Even these may forget, but I will not forget you. Behold, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands, and your walls are continually before me. He is the God of the whips. That's the only God there is. But he's the God of the whips because he loves you. And he is doing something that is great and that is mysterious and that we won't understand until the third day. But he hasn't forgotten you. Please pray with me.